Mr. Yee, the Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Let me see it, please. Tomorrow, all the others in this. Along with the others, you will see the showing of this matter all along. Canvas and very pleased to be here with you all today. But it's, April 10, 2024, and the first case of the day is COI versus Desiree William Carson. Case number 50130. Desiree Carson appeals in this matter, represented by Kenny Swinberg. COI will respond, represented by John McKinney. Counsel, either do you have any preliminary matters for us or other?
Wait a minute. May proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. Ms. Carson appeals from the district court's order denying her motion for reimbursement. Ms. Carson sought about $550 in reimbursement after her criminal conviction was denied. The district court denied her motion with a special appeal to that lacked jurisdiction to order that reimbursement. The district court, however, erred in its decision because it had both jurisdiction and the legal authority to grant Ms. Carson's motion. I want to briefly talk about jurisdiction before turning to the district court's legal authority to grant this motion. On jurisdiction, the district court had both subject matter and personal jurisdiction to rule on Ms. Carson's motion. As for subject matter jurisdiction, Ms. Carson filed her motion just one day after the district court's dismissal order. That is mildly 42 days before the district court's dismissal order would become final. So therefore, the district court has subject matter jurisdiction to rule on this motion. On personal jurisdiction, again, Ms. Carson filed her motion in this criminal case for the opposing party, the state of Idaho, to do something. There is no dispute, I think, that this is a criminal action between the defendant, Ms. Carson, and the state of Idaho. There is no evidence that jurisdiction has lapsed or that the district court lost jurisdiction with respect to one of the parties in this case. So the district court had personal jurisdiction over Ms. Carson and the state of Idaho to rule on this motion.
There may be evidence of jurisdiction in Ms. Carson's filing motion before we heard it.
Yes, it would for subject matter jurisdiction purposes, Your Honor. I think from this court decision in Jacoby, and the Peterson decision in the court of appeals as well, support that the district court has filed an untimely motion, the district court may have lost subject matter jurisdiction to rule on it. So I have no dispute in this case that the district court's legal authority to grant this motion. But I'm not going through the rule that the district court does have that legal authority. The district court's authority is rooted in the due process clause of the United States Constitution. Nelson framed the question on appeal that whether a state was obligated to refund the defendant after the conviction was invalidated. The Nelson court answered this question yes, without any qualifications or restrictions. As the Martinez Court, which I expect to migrate from the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, stated, once a criminal conviction is invalidated, due process requires the state to refund the monetary infractions imposed on the defendant upon that invalidated conviction.
Well, let me take that a little bit and give you that a due process case can be self-worthy. If the mind would be, if there were a pain drive, the defendant in this case, for example, was restitution that had gone to the victim, would there have been a ruling then to order the victim to disgorge that money?
I'd like to answer your question in two parts, General. First, with respect to due process clause, giving the district court's authority, I think the answer is yes. Another example that I thought of was Brady. That's where the due process clause that the state has to disclose to our evidence. The district court can order the state pursuant to that due process clause authority to comply with constitutional imperatives. So we do have other examples where the district court has authority rooted in the Constitution to order a party to do something. With respect to the third party victims, that's a very interesting question, Your Honor. I refer to return to the court to not go that far in this opinion as to address that, because we only have what are called state-based restitution. Ms. Grimes only orders to pay restitution to the Idaho State Police, they are a state agency. That doesn't mean actually they're going to a drinking and driving fine to enforce that. What we don't have is the third victim restitution. With respect to the third victim restitution, it is clear there could be questions in the trial of how they are the Martinez court in Massachusetts noted in not addressing the issue because it wasn't present there. That it seems that Nelson would go so far as to hold that the state doesn't have to refund the defendant for any third-party victim restitution that the defendant paid. The Martinez court sort of speculated that that may be what Nelson holds because Nelson said restitution has to be refunded by the state, and some of the restitution that the defendant, when the defendant paid in Nelson, did go to counsel for victim. But the Martinez court said, we're not going to address that here because, again, we have state-based restitution, and that is a very much more difficult question for the court, how we deal with three parties, the state, the victim, and the defendant, whether we should say that this has to be a criminal for the defendant trying to get the money back from the victim, or we say in the criminal case that the state has to refund the defendant and the state can try to get reimbursement from the victim.
I understand the practicalities and why Massachusetts court wouldn't go that far, but it seems to me that the third-party victim example does test the boundaries of the assertion that Nelson relies on authority.
Well, I think Nelson could be interpreted to provide authority, Your Honor, that the state would have to reimburse the defendant if they had to give restitution to the victim. And the reason for that means that the basis of the Nelson report is that once that conviction is invalidated, the defendant is not required to pay that money anymore. There is no longer a state right to that money. So the defendant has to be the whole to get that money back. The party that pursues the conviction is the state of Idaho. They initiated criminal action. They are seeking to obtain that criminal conviction that has those orders in there that the defendant has to file certain kinds of custody or pay certain kinds of fees, restitution. So in the end, the state is responsible for refunding the defendant in the event that their conviction is invalidated. Again, I would suggest that the court follow the Martinez approach and not address third-party victims because I think there are variables there, such as whether the victim has a separate civil judgment or is pursuing a separate civil case against the defendant, or if they're enforcing that restitution judgment civilly. I think there's other questions there. I think probably the state would also want an opportunity to brief whether the state would be one of to refund the defendant. Here we have state-based restitution, and it's very clear from Nelson that the state must refund the defendant's money.
Same is just state-based restitution. And in Crouch's case, it is almost that simple, but it's not always that simple. The state got lots of buckets, and the money gets sent for lots of buckets. So to say there are no third parties involved in this, is that technically correct?
I think you're pointing out a great question between sort of how the state logistically enforces this, where they get the money, and whether Ms. Crouch has the right to this money. Under the Republican Scholarship, yes, we have the right to this money back. The state has, again, no basis to withhold this money from her. It's her conviction has been erased. The enforcement or how the state goes about that is a separate question, but I don't think that this court or the district court really needs to or should address. I think it is best left to the state to decide how they are going to refund this money to this cost.
So what I hear you saying is just because it would be difficult for the state doesn't mean that's not a problem, that's the state's problem.
Correct, Your Honor. And that will extinguish this cost right in as much as because the state may have to make it difficult for them. They may have to meet with a few different agencies and entities to figure out how to get this check to her. The state is in the best position to do this, as opposed to Ms. Karst filing potentially 10 or more civil suits to all separate agencies that brought the money.
Well, I was wondering, Nelson, there's a couple of justifications there. One is state, you put this train on track and you started this criminal case, but I also read Nelson to say, you created these statutes that say we're going to have these fees and fines and they're going to go to these places, and if you don't provide an equivalent statute to say how somebody gets that money back when their conviction is invalidated, because you created the scheme, because you served the case, you figure out how to do it. And if you want to pass a statute, and that's kind of what Martinez gets into, if you want to pass a statute to fix it, that's great, but you can't just wash your hands and absolve yourself of everything when your actions go through the statutes in commencing the criminal case that caused this defendant to be displaced. Am I reading the announcement correctly?
Yes, I think you are absolutely reading it correctly, Your Honor. And that was briefly to what the court looked at in Nelson, is that Matthew the owner's boundary test. So we obviously have the defendant has absolute rights to his money. The state has no interest in this money. So now we're looking at the remaining factor, which means we're very civil voting separation with the current procedure that we have right now. Here we have a lack of procedure. There is no easy statutory scheme for the defendant in the criminal case to obtain the money. We have no scheme, which means the default is a civil case. Based on my comments, this person money went to 11 different bodies that serve sub-agencies. So theoretically, she would have to file 11 separate civil actions to get this money back from her invalidated conviction. That certainly is not a minimally burdensome procedure, which is all due process requires.
Well, and she doesn't know about the commence, though. She bears the burden of proof in every single one of those cases, right?
Correct.
And I don't see anywhere in the record where anybody has, where the lawyers or the district court has actually said what would be the civil cause of action that would be filed. Because if it's, for example, a tort, any city or county where you see money or governmental entity is going to have potentially some defenses that would get a tort concept, right?
Right, and there, that's something that Malcolm discussed, Your Honor, that's not only that there are no one statutory scheme with the clear convincing evidence standard, there was that the defendant shouldn't be saddled with any burden of proof at all. That was a reason why the Colorado Act was to burden them. The defendant shouldn't be saddled with any burden of proof. They basically shouldn't have to jump through any loops to be able to get this money back. And sort of what we were touching on this is why. That already cost prohibitive.
But even in Massachusetts case, they found that the defendant had a burden of production. They have to initially show that they paid a fine, that the fine was later invalidated. They had to just a couple of base things they had to show, and then the burden shifted, correct?
Correct. And I think in this case, if we're looking at what Massachusetts did, this person met that line of production here. She filed a motion and included a sheet with that motion that showed the money that she paid. And the district court found that there is no dispute that this is the amount that she paid. So
there is a hurdle, it's just a very low hurdle. And then the burden shifts and it's much higher for the state.
Correct. The state can say if you didn't actually pay all of that money or something like that, then you want to dispute it. And I'm saying the due process. The due process protection means there's no procedure at all, but it just has to be a minimally burdensome procedure where there's no risk of erroneous deprivation. With this default civil suit, or multiple civil suits that this person has to file, there is that risk of erroneous deprivation.
Well, I'll ask the question, why does there even need to be? If the defendant's conviction is dismissed, why is the state trying to keep the money fighting that provision?
Why does the state have to prove?
Why does the defendant have to prove anything?
Well,
what can we in the state that you have to ask to get your money back?
Well, some states, Your Honor, do automatically refile the defendant either by common law or by statute, which is written here. There's an automatic refund. We don't have a scheme there yet. Well, this court certainly could adopt a court ruling or the legislature may want to get involved in how this would go moving forward. So I don't think there's a problem with having that minimal burden of production for the defendant to file that timing motion. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be automatic by statute or by common law.
I just forgot an indigent defendant is no longer represented having to can't get access to a public defender just to ask for a refund. Knowing how to do it, they might just decide not to.
Yeah, that is a concern. I think if the case goes to a box, so if this court is going to appeal, invalidate a case on appeal, it's going to go back and then presumably the district court's going to issue that order of dismissal. So hopefully, independent would have to have a lot of time to guide them to that process and advise them, but now how are you pushing for reimbursement? And that kind of brings me to another point of how rare I think these cases are. We know that the Nelson decision came out in 2017 and now we're in 2024 arguing about it for the first time. See, a lot of things have to happen for an defendant to be entitled to reimbursement. First, the conviction has to be overturned on appeal by this court or the court of appeal. Then the case has to be dismissed. Normally, when we win on appeal, it's for a retrial or something like that, or the defendant may get to it again. And then also, the defendant has to be paid. Usually, that's suspended at the operation or making some payments in another way. So, this is a very rare situation. I don't think the state is going to be letting or writing checks to the defendant before they should get reimbursement.
Are you suggesting not reimbursement in cases?
So, post-conviction, there are certain things that happen. She was on probation. She paid for community service, for example. And I guess I'm specifically concerned about that. It looks like based on the amount paid, that there was a payment made for the insurance portion of that. If she performed the community service, the insurance is paid. It's not just plunking funds, money into a fund, like court costs might be, but it's actually paying for a service. And I presume that she asked for probation, which implicitly is also requesting community service because it would be required. Is there any carve out for something like that for a amount that's been earned?
In the Martinez court, I mean, we discussed is what there's sort of different kinds of treatment, and sort of which one would be appropriate to be reimbursed and which one would be. Probation falls under something that would be appropriate for reimbursement. That is something that is kind of happening to pursue as an object of that conviction. So that would be that she should get back. She wouldn't have had to do probation if she wouldn't have had that conviction, so that should be restored to her. And so,
This is a case where I think the discussion has been fairly involved at this point, and I'd like to back up a little bit and point out to meet with the benefit of the listening from the law school the greater issue. In this case, nobody disputes that Ms. Carst could be treated unfairly, but it would be unfair for her not to get her $569, 50 cents back from somebody. And the only judge, Dr. Freeman, said it was unfair. And then we'll be back up to 2012. Judge Lansing of the Court of Appeals said, in almost an exactly same scenario, that it was unfair. And she was very, very meticulous as a judge, and she wrote that, unfortunately, as a fair as it was, she said that's the only recourse for people in Peterson's position is to file a separate lawsuit naming as a defendant each public agency that received a portion of its payments. Nothing has changed since 2012. And the Peterson case came out of the heels of this court's decision in Cooper, which kind of a more limited scenario, but it's still the same, where the defendant went on appeal and it was not possible to have a retrial. And there was a request for reimbursement of payments made to the compensation fund through the Industrial Commission by the law. And this court said the same thing, which was what the Peterson court based its decision on, which was personal jurisdiction available for the state to go after the Industrial Commission, which was a state agency. It was not a party. And so in order to see those not happen, there has to be a new personal jurisdiction or personal established against the Industrial Commission. And in the case of the court said the same thing, to go against all those entities that were part of this proceeding that do hold the money, there has to be service of process, which means that someone's in a complaint.
Just to circle back for a second, you made a comment earlier that nothing's changed since Judge Lansing's decision in 2012.
Yes.
But we have Nelson since 2012.
Mm-hmm.
We did that in 2017 case. Didn't that fundamentally change things?
Well, Nelson starts to fall a little bit in that direction. The Supreme Court, I mean, this is really important to distinguish between what's being surveyed in Nelson. Which are more equitable in nature and talk about fairness and generalities. But that's dicta. And as the court knows, you can't rely on dicta. You have to rely on what the specific ruling of the court is. And Nelson, the specific ruling was that Colorado's statutory scheme violated the 14th Amendment due process because, and anybody would have said this, that in order to get reimbursed, former defendant, or somebody making that petition, would have to prove that they were innocent of the underlying charge and establish that proof by clear and convincing evidence. two standards that aren't even applied in the initial criminal proceeding, where it's proof beyond reasonable doubts, and certainly doesn't come clear, or close to clear convincing evidence. And it's the state's burden in a criminal case, of course, to prove that the system is guilty beyond reasonable doubt. So the standard in Colorado is incredibly high, and even a higher one, to prove innocence by clear and convincing evidence. And that was the holding in Nelson versus Colorado. That is the strict holding that this court and all courts in land have to abide by.
In Nelson, they also talk about general due process principles. And so, we didn't have a due process claim or argument raised in Peterson, as far as I can tell. And so, don't we need to analyze the due process argument here? And the due process argument isn't, as I agree with it, isn't limited to a return of money from the entities that received their percentage of the fees, because they're paid to the court by state law. Portions of the fees are distributed to a variety of entities. Why don't we analyze the due process argument vis-a-vis the state here? Why don't we have personal jurisdiction on the state? Because the state commenced the criminal proceeding that resulted in the order to pay IT fees.
Because the state doesn't have the money. The state never had the money. It was ordered by the state. That this money was distributed, first paid to the clerk of the district court, which I think in Cooper, this court made clear, is not a party.
So why does the due process claim depend on whether the state has the money or not? Doesn't it turn on the state's conduct? And the state's conduct was commencing the proceeding, passing statutes that require these to be ordered, and then not implementing the process that satisfies due process to obtain return or erroneously imposed fines and fees in the event of a conviction is vacated.
I can't disagree with that, so Justice Song, but what I'd say is all roads lead to a courtroom where there has to be somebody who has had personal jurisdiction established against them. So whether or not there's a due process violation by somebody in some generic way, for instance, the court in Massachusetts, whose name escapes me right now, Martinez, said that this has to be done. And we're backing up and telling the state how to do it. We're just going to wash our hands and we're going to say, yes, due process has been done. This is very unfair. And so we are going to order that this be rectified, so we're sending it back to the state, and the state has to do something about this to rectify it, but we're not going to tell them how. And the obvious reason they're not going to tell them how is because there's a personal jurisdiction question burning at the border. Who has the money? And in this case, we are different from most all the cases that I read. The district court has to retain all of the money. All the money has been distributed throughout the lands. The Idaho, the office, the 11 entities has the money, and we have to get them to get the money back. The state of Idaho does not have the money. The district court doesn't have the money.
Who is the state of Idaho? Is the state of Idaho the prosecutor for the county? The state of Idaho?
Well,
all the branches of the government, all the associated agencies, who's the state of Idaho? Because the state doesn't have money. When I look at the distribution of us, you know, I see emergency surcharge fees, drug violation, hotline fees, peace officer detentions, peace officer standards and training. I even see the core technology fund. Well, this is a recipient of this money. I don't know if that takes conflict of interest for us, it's only $10, but the point is, who is the state? And why shouldn't we look at the state broadly?
Well, I can answer that in a minute. The state is not prosecutor. This Gordon Hooper said, and I'll quote, the idea that the county prosecutor qualifies as either a state agency or a political subdivision. We will talk about one prosecutor in crime. The county prosecutor is representing the state. And it's inherent sovereign power to do exactly that, to prosecute crime. So the state, the prosecutors aren't the state. They represent the state for the ruling purpose of prosecuting crimes. So the state is evil in kind of a generic sense. The state of Idaho never had one. There's not a fund that says state of Idaho where Ms. Carr's paid her monies into either permanently or temporarily to be dispersed. It wasn't the district court clerk. And I think Cooper also makes clear after Peterson says that there's no appearance authority of the district court or the court clerk to make these payments.
But the same article, you know, just as a statute, since my tenure on the board again, creating the priority of payments, I mean, the IRA priority is full of provisions that require payment of funds with these different agencies, different funds, and then finally, because of the implementation policy, we had to create a system. The legislature had to tell the courts how this money is to be distributed and what the priority is. The state told us exactly who gets the first dollar, who gets the second dollar, who gets the third dollar. The state is directing orders. The legislature.
Correct, and the state doing that doesn't answer the question who has Ms. Clark's money.
But why isn't it a matter of accounting, a matter of electronic transfers, better term, perhaps, debits and credits? Insurance companies do this with reimbursements to doctor's offices, and why can't the state have a system that would be as simple as we have to pay someone back, so your amount going to you is now debited by that amount. Isn't that simple?
The state has no anonymous to put it honestly, how it's done is apart from us. We're not saying anything other than in this case, as in Uber, as in Peterson, there's no personal jurisdiction. We're not finding that there's an unfairness here. There may even be a due process violation where whoever has the money is able to retain it. What we're saying is that there's no way to get personal jurisdiction unless, as Judge Weinstein said, someone's in complaint filed against those who have the money.
And my hang-up with your arguments, McKinney, is that there's been a lot of constitutional litigation with that of the state for a number of years. In a due process claim, the question is who violated my rights? It's not, I mean, generally it lines up with who took my property without due process, but sometimes somebody else has the property, and the only reason they have the property is because the state passed a law that said, hey, you can take this. And so it's the person, in my experience, and so help me understand why is personal jurisdiction here turn on who has the money as opposed to who has the law that deprived me of my money?
But then those questions need to be hammered out in a civil life proceeding.
But no, I'm talking about for purposes of personal jurisdiction, whether a trial court had personal jurisdiction, why does it matter who has the money? Why is the question about personal jurisdiction answered by who has the law that took my money?
Well, trying to make the state legislators of IFO responsible for that would be problematic, I think, in this situation. And if they are, as you say, I think correctly, to make the argument that they are the entity that is responsible for these requirements that these monies be paid. So they have these 11 IMS payments that have been done by us, and assuming they're all pursuant to the legislature's passing the laws, then the legislature ultimately would be, based on that article, would be the responsible party. And there's no way that you can make the legislature responsible ultimately for this.
But they are acting on behalf of the state of Idaho. I don't think the proper party would be all 100 powerful legislators. It's the state of Idaho. The legislature acts, they act as on behalf of the state of Idaho. And so that's what I'm saying. Why isn't personal jurisdiction here appropriate over the state of Idaho who commenced this case and passed the law that deprived her of this money?
That would be, and I'm not sure who, on a personal local level, would be in the representative capacity of the legislature now. And we talked about the prosecutor, this is the proper party to bring and to represent even the legislature in that scenario.
It just seems to me that in every prosecution, big or small, the state has a huge privilege of being able to call themselves the state of Idaho. Some states, they call them people in the state of Idaho. Yes, so they have the privilege of calling themselves the state of Idaho. But it seems like now when we're talking about giving somebody a refund that they're due, we're saying, oh, we need state with a small s, not capital s. I can't think of any other party that would appear before us admitting that somebody was owed money and saying, well, we can't pay her back because it's too complicated, and so you shouldn't make us. I'm not sure it's our duty, just as Massachusetts suggested, to figure out how. Are we only suggesting that individual legislators or the legislature, the body, is responsible for this? But that maybe we have to figure out how to do that. But the bottom line is, the state with a capital S received money that it wasn't entitled to, and you admit in fairness and perhaps in due process, they should get that money to the person that they got it from.
Maybe more than all that should, in fairness, get a path in this car. So if a entity at the state police has received funds, they should give a path. But as it stands now, they're not, there's no personal jurisdiction to bring them into court and to order them to. So that's the problem. And certainly the prosecutor, I've been a prosecution for about 15 years in court settings. And the prosecutor may need to have the state of Idaho and refer to it as the state, but just representing people at the state of Idaho for that limited function. They are not, can you imagine that if they were to, personally, I don't think you're talking about personally making the prosecutors pay the money back. So it would be the county conference, I think, Justice Moore, you're talking about. And if there were, in this case here, it's $569, who cares? It's a lot, it's very, you know, it's money. But if it were thousands and thousands of dollars that had been paid in the interim before the condition was overturned, that would cause havoc to the district court. Assuming the district court still had money to then have to turn around and pay it. So I think there's a lot of issues here that haven't been resolved. And I think the Martinez case that's been brought up, I would be recalcitrant if I didn't mention. Two problems that really come out with Martinez. And first was that in Massachusetts, almost all certain exceptions of the funds went to the general fund. So if you're going to follow the rule of personal jurisdiction, and if a representative of the general fund has to be summoned and served with a complaint, okay, that's one time that has to happen. But in Massachusetts, the general fund holds just about all of the monies that are paid, with some exceptions. So it's going to be a lot easier in Massachusetts than it is with the 11 distributees of funds here. And secondly, Massachusetts had an incredibly special circumstance, which, without saying, I think caused the response that they had. And they said that they had, due to the response of two land people throughout the state, they had 21,000 cases invalidated because of one of the lab person's misconduct. And then the other lab person's misconduct, they just said thousands of cases were invalidated. So Massachusetts, you know, Martinez was looking at thousands and thousands of cases where people were going to want their money back. And so they basically said, yeah, this is wrong. It's a due process violation. They saved their money and they didn't get the money back. And now we're going to wash our hands and not help them at all and tell them how to get a cash. And I did a little research, and there's another Supreme Court case and says, follow up on that. We have no advice on how to get that done. It's a problem. And Colorado tried to say that signs that problem and it's one of the remedy they got wrong. Yeah. Having a statutory scheme would be good. That would be good. I don't want a statutory scheme to help people who are in this situation of unfairness as this cost. But you know, in Colorado, when they wrote this, I don't know what was going on, but to have the person that you approved innocence by clear and convincing evidence, that is a shocking violation of due process. And so there's a big gap between what they said, what happened. What they were requiring, which was minimal procedures. If you can't go beyond minimal procedures, well, they didn't define what minimal procedures were. They just said that should be the case. And so we don't have that here. Russell really doesn't apply.
Right, you have a solution, which is you tell the district court that it should serve money. that the working manager would order the state of Idaho to pay, then the court can issue a writ of execution that authorizes Ms. Harris to obtain funds in any way, whether it's a garnishment, etc. They can garnish bank accounts, they can garnish payments owed by, you know, let's say tax receipts from a grocery chain. What's wrong with that solution?
Well, there's a lot of rumors. I'm not a civil lawyer, so I don't know a lot about this. It seems to me at some point, whoever you're going to take that money from will have to be held in court to a substantive complaint and have the ability to turn it off if they can.
That's my point. The state of Idaho is represented in the case. They commenced the case. The county prosecutor reacted on behalf of the state of Idaho, and I would suggest the process is far more streamlined than Joseph Burney suggests. Whenever the judgment is entered against the state, it goes to the board examiners. All claims against the state are presented to the board examiners. They need promptly a group payment. That's all it is. State of Idaho needs to pay. It's presented to the board examiners. Board examiners reviews it, goes on it, approves it, says yes, treasurer, go ahead and pay it. It's that simple. And so and then it's up to the state to decide to need to justify it or not implement a process going out and charge back all the entities that receive the parts of that, or, you know, they could choose to do something like the compensation for the wrongfully convicted and just say, we'll go ahead and that's a cost of the career there, and we won't ask for reimbursement from an entity that, you know, engaged in misconduct in the case of that act. So, I mean, the state isn't, I don't know that I'm seeing this as particularly difficult here, and I'm struggling to understand why the due process claim, personal jurisdiction, turns on who has the money. I think it turns on whose behavior caused the deprivation, and it strikes me as the state right now.
Well, I would differ on that. If the law were such that the person seeking reimbursement would go after the prosecutor, and the prosecutor has never held the money, the court could order it, but I don't know what authority the court would have to order somebody who doesn't hold the funds of somebody to pay it back. Now, it will not be subject to a jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction. It's just a matter of authority. What authority would the court have to order somebody who doesn't have it to pay it back? And that's the ultimate question on that. That you're suggesting is that just get it done, Mr. Prosecutor, just represent the states, and we don't care how you do it, but whatever's been suggested here.
It's not a prosecutor, it's the state. The only reason the fines and fees are imposed is because the state of Idaho passed a statute or a series of statutes that says that once somebody is convicted of a crime, that person has to pay these amounts. That's why they're ordered in criminal cases when somebody is convicted, right?
Right. And as we got that earlier, how far you got that? You go to the legislature, you go to the union who shepherded the law through. The prosecutor, the court, the local court, the district court, of course, sure, they're all kind of causing the wheel. They are implementing what has been passed by the legislature. And if it's a legislative provision that orders court costs, and that's why the entity now has it, ultimately, then I don't think there's anything you can adjudicate that through the legislators, whether it's perceived to be inaction or the wrongful action. But here, I guess the argument would be that the prosecutor prosecuted the crime and it's heading to the state of Idaho and this conviction's now in lower terms, and now the prosecutor's office should pay the time. And that leads to all sorts of questions. First of all, yes, I think we're pretty sad. If the prosecutor representing the state of Idaho is now in the position of giving that money back, they're in a conflict position big time. They're now another, in effect, representing the person seeking reimbursement and how to get that, issuing subpoenas, filing the summons and complaint, and trying to get that whoever holds the money in court to get it back. That's a conflict.
But isn't the state why the conflict arguments are just washing over the fact that the state of Idaho is an entity that is separate and apart from the government, that's separate and apart from the legislature, that's separate and apart from the prosecuting attorney? The state of Idaho is an entity, right?
In essence, it's the people of the state harbor. And
it's even more than that, right? It's own being, if you will.
I'm not sure about that. I think it's the people of CLI and this court in Cooper really separated the prosecutor's function from being this amorphous sea of Idaho. And I think that's what we're talking about. The amorphous sea of Idaho, the people of the sea of Idaho. You can't shun the prosecutor in his duties as being one thing with being the sea of Idaho. They're different. The sea of Idaho is all of us together in this room throughout the state. That's the sea of Idaho, the people. And
well, the defendant is also part of the state of Idaho, then, so I mean, I guess we have a conflict in every case.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the defendant is part of the state of Idaho. So that, to me, is really how this court approaches it. Ultimately, it's going to end up at the district court, where Judge Wayman said, looking at Peterson and Hoover, there's no personal jurisdiction. And in looking at the case law of the district courts, the order from the district court? No, from Hoover and the language of Hoover. The order from the prosecutor? Well, that doesn't make sense. Who would there be? And so he was looking at who was responsible in the chain of commands of this law going down and eventually resulting in this cost being paid. The legislature, the district court, the prosecutor, that's a long list of people who might be responsible for it.
I'm just spitballing here. Maybe the problem is if you disperse the funds too quickly. Perhaps when a fine is paid, perhaps when you distribute it to all these different agencies too quickly, knowing the case might be appealed, perhaps there should be a waiting period before it's distributed to all these agencies, especially if the case is on appeal.
Well, if you're not in that position, Justice Moore, I think there will be an extreme harm in the cases I've seen where counseling services and all sorts of things are rendered immediately. And, so
I think I agree with you in the case of restitution, but what about these other things?
That would be a valid consideration, I think. However, you never know what cases, how far they're going to go, how long it's going to take to have an appeal.
What
do you think? Well, what the process in doing the press position, she could have on appeal, and so that's
right. Right. If it's appeal, most cases aren't. Yes. So keep the money for 42 days, then you send it out.
Now,
if it's appeal, there's only going to be a small subset of cases that are appealed. Maybe we shouldn't distribute this money to after the appeal is adjudicated.
Well, that makes sense. I think that's where if that were the case, for non-appealable cases. But,
and by the way, if we should do that, maybe we should think about
that. That would be a real problem to how we're going to put in play that, yes.
Well, in terms of practical realities, if there is no easy remedy, do we encourage every defendant to move to stay the payment of the fines and fees pending the outcome on appeal? And do we really want to go down that road?
Absolutely not. So that's a very good point. And no, so this is a problem, a huge problem. And again, Ms. Carr's deserves her money. She wins, and she needs to have it back. How it's done, it will be sort of ultimately, and just the main barrier is personal jurisdiction by who has the money. And there's both the money way to get around that, and it's there to discharge things. And does it create havoc to the court system? It's in the source out. And I would just add that I don't think most of what has been argued here today was argued for laws. I think a lot of it is new constitutional argument and very interesting procedural difficulties that are presented. But it was very limited argument of law. It was kind of that issue is not argued about Peterson and then fairness in general, but I don't think it was a lot of the points that were made. Today were presented well. So, with that, I would just submit on the state's brief on the issue of subject jurisdiction waiver or not. And unless there are any other questions, that is what to report the use of the court response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Council. I hope to pick up a state left off with consideration. I know there's definitely disagree. I think the argument is
court after this was filed in motion for reimbursement in the state of Jeffrey McPherson. Peter's first counsel filed a response to that with this document of the museum. That was, I think, what we were looking at through the record today, and then jurisdiction of McPherson. So I think that these issues are preserved for the court that I discussed today. Jeff was murmured, we discussed potential staying being on appeal, and maybe the district court holding that. I remember that other jurisdictions that he discussed in the Nelson case do have automatic stay on those findings being escaped the head of the field. Often the court could have gotten more like that if also could have to. As I noted, I think it's more of the American cases where we have this situation where the defendant is entitled to reimbursement, but some jurisdictions do have that stay.
And this is what I guess that's what I've been addressing with almost throughout this entire argument today is this a procedural rule-based answer or a statutory substantive-based answer? Is it aligned with us? I know in the Washington Supreme Court invalidated their simple possession statute. What I understand there, and the state also courts has to deal with how to pay back thousands of people for wrongful convictions of possession in Washington. Should that lie the fee of argument get off the horse by just passing some rule? Is it not a right slavery has to do it? We follow what Justice Song's thinking and say, well, we're examined. You figure it out. So if you have any good insight on procedural, rule based, substantive, statute based, we just do a Martinez and step back.
I would say on one constitution the court's authority to prevent this due process violation. Each state can handle it differently. Some have to operate with health rule, some just go with the common law that provides that these will just be refunded. Some may have a legislature that intervene often called by the parents and just work out for them. We are in the way that each state can handle it. But I think at the end of the day for this court, there is a continuing due process violation, and it can remedy that by remanding the case for the district court to inform the state to reimburse this cost, whether this court may want to adopt a rule or the legislature to act could be something that they could do, but I don't think it happens. Justice Song pointed out there is a simple way for the state to reimburse this cost.
My point is sometimes the board is in the session of who the claim. And so I guess maybe it's my past experience in that sometimes a person needs more than just an order for the state to do something, and sometimes you have to have additional tools in your toolbox to actually force the issue. And I guess that's my experience. How can the Ministry of Justice, that is my, how far does this work go at this juncture in terms of shaping process,
giving
guidance to shape the process?
I think that most of this court was used for what the court said that we were not attempting to specify the right meaning by which such came to the Congress, but expect to say that the court must formally be run in the Commonwealth less time to provide that order. I think that's what the corporate order they could decide here, and then down the line, we have to deal with the state not complying with the district court's order. We can zero that if that kind of problem under the right state would comply with without order from the judge. We have to cross that bridge to get there. Obviously, we deal with it. That I think all this court needs to do is say there is that injury to this car, but in that continuing due process violation, the state has to refund this car's back money. With time remaining, I wanted to bring to touch on the same claim that the state doesn't have the money anymore, so that releases it as jurisdiction, and that distinguishes the case from Nelson. I disagree with that. In Nelson, the defendants paid the money in 2005 or 2006, so that money was long gone. The state of Colorado even argued before the Supreme Court that we don't have this money anymore. This money has been distributed to private funds or public funds, so the state of Florida can't pay the defendant's money back anymore. That's what Justice Thomas discussed in his dissent, which was not granted. He also decided to run. But Justice Thomas would say that, well, Colorado doesn't have this money anymore, so they can't be ordered to pay it back. Obviously, that's not how that's decided. Justice Thomas wasn't in the opinion.
And so I urge this court not to allow the state's position, not just because it has distributed this money, that now Ms. Clark doesn't have a right to get this money back. And I also just want to emphasize that Ms. Clark is not asking for the state to give her the exact $100 or $1 that she paid to the district court for. This is just that this is the money that she paid, but the state has to reimburse that money to her. I also would disagree that this is going to wreak havoc on the district court, that the district court is going to be flooded with all the claims. Again, I said this was very limited, but I think it's important also to remember that this is not money that the state was entitled to in the first place. Once that conviction was invalidated, the state no longer has the right to that money. So effectively, like, doesn't have that right to that money at all. So if the state maybe for more needs to account for a very small number of convictions being invalidated and having to give that money back, they want to put in a buffer of, $500 or $1,000 over 7 years, but it's going to have to be back to the defendants for their valid convictions. But I don't think this will wreak havoc of the district court clerks or board examiners or county prosecutors complying with the district court's order. Just briefly, my last point is that when with respect to jurisdiction. In most cases, the defendant sought reimbursement in a criminal case from a specific state entity or set agency or even Pearson, the district court clerk. We are not seeking reimbursement from a specific type entity, as this court has discussed, and this court saw the motion for the state of Idaho to do that reimbursement. The state of Idaho is a party in this case, and so the district court has special jurisdiction. I think that's where this court could distinguish or limit Peterson and Hoover to be there, and it went after the non-party, it went after somebody who was in the criminal case. But here, this testimony is really fresh to the state of Idaho. So now this court has any questions, and that the court is being reviewed.
Thank you very much, Council. We really appreciate your argument today, Saturday, and your time. And we will end the decision accordingly. We'll be in recess until a while. Thank you.